We talk a lot about our partners and the products and the amazing things they make, and you should have them year round. But they're also going to make awesome Christmas presents. So let me just remind you, you have the Any Day Cookware. It is a fantastic gift for storing food, cooking food, serving food. You don't even have to use the microwave. They're just great containers, but we have made the IO series, and you can visit us at cookanyday.com. Use the promo code DAVE and get 10% off. It's a great, great gift for college kids, first time, you know, new graduates, professional cooks, you name it. Athletic Brewing is something that I'm drinking a lot, especially with the new year coming up. It's a great gift for people that are trying to drink less. And honestly, like I just drink it all the time because it's a great beverage, let alone it's one of the best, if not the best. It is not if not. It is the best non-alcoholic beverage around. Visit us at athleticbrewing.com and you can use the promo code ATHLETICGIFT20 for 20% off. There's East Fork Pottery. They make great stuff for us. 15% off. And Friend of Dave, one word, is the code. Comet to Your Coffee is the gift that I will be giving people as well. It is literally, I don't know anybody that's not going to want it, especially if they like coffee and especially if they're lazy like I am, or if they do like making coffee. I know all kinds of coffee drinkers that are drinking this because it's so quick. It's so easy. Comet to Your Coffee is a great gift. $40 off your first two purchases when you visit cometier.com/Chang, C-H-A-N-G. And of course, great gift of pantry items from Momofuku for yourself or for anybody else. Visit us, shop.momofuku.com. You can use the promo code DOMO10, D-O-M-O-10, for the full line of the Momofuku goods, pantry items, the instant noodles, the chili crunch, the salt spices, or you can visit us nationwide at Whole Foods, Target, and your great supermarkets near you. All right, guys, it is Monday, the Monday before Thanksgiving. Feel like a lot of people will be traveling either today or tomorrow. So a good chance you might be listening to this on the road. So best of luck, man. This is easily one of the worst days of traveling. I am traveling to New York City myself for the Black Friday game for Thursday Night Football. Reminder that on Friday, it's the first ever NFL game on Friday. Usually you have the Lions and the Cowboys playing Thanksgiving Day, but Amazon and Thursday Night Football is providing a game on Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The New York Jets versus Miami Dolphins. I will be cooking up a storm, tailgating, really seeing all the delicious things, tasting all the delicious things that the Jets fans will be cooking up. I think I'm going to be making a stop at the Jets facilities. And during the game, I'm going to be making the first ever inaugural Black Friday leftover Thanksgiving Day sandwich for the MVP of the game. So excited to hang with Carissa Thompson, Andrew Whitworth, Richard Sherman, Ryan Fitzpatrick, and Tony Gonzalez on Black Friday. Currently, I am in Las Vegas. I'm on the road a lot, and I'm in Las Vegas for the F1 race. The first ever Las Vegas Grand Prix. Very excited. I have never been to one. There's a lot of construction. There's a lot of people. This is something like I've never seen. I've been in Vegas a lot over the years for all kinds of events, fights, bouts. There's a Super Bowl coming up, but this is something that Las Vegas has never seen before. I just learned that there actually was an F1 race in Las Vegas 41 years ago, but it was a very different time and different era of F1. And now with the Netflix series Drive to Survive, there's a lot of people that are completely new to the sport here in Las Vegas, excited to see what's about to happen because it's hard to describe if you're not here. The anticipation and a lot of the construction, it's, you know, fundamentally transformed Las Vegas. Anyway, let's get on to the show.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Pure Leaf Iced Tea. Great iced tea takes you somewhere else, like new Pure Leaf Blackberry Iced Tea that we have here at the Spotify Studios and drink quite a bit, where unexpectedly blackberry flavor transports you to a berry delicious place. So refreshing, you may never want to leave. You will eventually have to, though, but take your time. Try new Pure Leaf Blackberry Iced Tea. Visit amazon.com/pureleaf and enter 20 Pure Leaf. That's 20 Pure Leaf for 20% off your purchase of new Pure Leaf Blackberry Iced Tea. Seeing that it's a travel day, travel week, Christian is not here, we're going to do an entire episode of Mailbags and Ask Dave. So we're going to keep it pretty dialed in on that. Nothing else, right? So let's get started. You know what we got?
All right. I mean, before we do that, it's the holidays, and that means there are some epic cooking catastrophe stories out there. We want to hear all about it. So you can also ask us to settle food disputes, respond to something we talk about on the pod, or ask Dave anything. Email us at askdave@majordomomedia.com or tag me, you know, on Discord. You can sign up for our Discord by going to majordomomedia.com. All right. So Ask Dave, Europe honeymoon. Hi, Dave. My name is Colby, and my wife and I are planning our honeymoon for mid-May 2024. We are starting our honeymoon in London, but can't seem to figure out where in Europe to go. So I own a small restaurant, and she's in the hospitality business. Any recommendation for cities, countries, and restaurants that we must visit? We are open to any suggestions in Europe. Thank you.
Do they describe what time frame? Like, how much time do they have to plan?
They did not give us a time frame. They just said it was going to be in May of next year.
Well, May of next year, I think Nomo will be closed. But Copenhagen is always wonderful, regardless. One of my favorite cities. May is a wonderful time to be there. It'll still be actually a little bit chilly, but it's super fucking cold in the wintertime. So May's great. I love all of Scandinavia. Stockholm's got great food. Norway. Oslo is... I haven't spent as much time in Oslo. Actually, I've only been to Oslo once. Stockholm, and more specifically Copenhagen, is just a wonderful place. And a lot of the places that you don't need reservations are great, but Christian Baumann's restaurant that I think got 2 stars is, I've been told, he's an adopted Korean and he's doing his version of Korean food. And I've been told by numerous people that it is truly delicious. So you might want to check that out. But if Copenhagen isn't on your radar and you have like a week, I honestly would forego going to France. Don't get mad. There's all kinds of great cities. But if I'm in London, again, the great thing about living in London is you're literally almost an hour flight away from everything. I would go to Spain and I would go to San Sebastian if you haven't been. And clearly I would do Elcano, which is an hour outside. You're going to need to find transportation. That can be the only difficulty besides getting a reservation. I would recommend eating for lunch as well. And Echebari, which is the well-known charcoal grilling restaurant that's been around for years. It has become sort of a must-do. These two restaurants are the must-do places. But there's so many Pincho bars. There's so many other restaurants. There's Muguritz. San Sebastian is a great city because I'm not even sure what to do culturally there. I've been there a lot because all I ever do there is eat. So I would just do San Sebastian for sure. Or check out Barcelona. But if you're not going to do Spain, Rome would be good. It's a nice, beautiful place. Somewhere in Florence would be good. Florence can be a little touristy. I understand Rome is clearly very touristy as well. But that might be cool. A city that you can walk around in. And Modena. You know, besides Massimo Vittura's restaurant, that's just a cool city, Bologna as well. So maybe Italy. I'm trying to think as a city that you could localize all of your sort of honeymoon holiday efforts on and just eat. I'm avoiding Paris because I think it's not that it's played out at all, but I wouldn't want to spend a week there on a honeymoon. But I'm going to have to because Grace really loves Paris. I'm not the biggest fan of Paris. I haven't been in a while. You know what? That's sort of close by. I'd go to Istanbul. I want a walking city. I want a place where you can discover things. You have some of the most beautiful mosques in all of the world there, and some of the most beautiful Christian cathedrals there as well. You have an old city, a new city. It is still to this day probably my favorite city I've ever been to. And the eating, from the high to the low, from kebabs and shawarmas and donut, it is just on a, it's so goddamn good. I would say maybe from London, and I mean, it's close enough, I would just do Istanbul. So that would be my, recommendation. I would do San Sebastian or Istanbul.
All right. Thanks, Dave. Okay. Our next one. And this is about Japanese whiskey. Hi, Dave. Big fan. I've been a fan of yours since I have seen an episode of one of Anthony Bourdain's shows. My question to you is, Japanese whiskey really better than Scotch? And have you ever been to a distillery in Scotland?
Here's the deal. Here's the deal. I'm not a big Scotch drinker. I've had way more Japanese Scotch and whiskey than actually Scotch from Scotland. I don't think I've even been to Scotland, so I couldn't have gone to a distillery. Have I been to Scotland? Maybe I have. It's been a long time. But, you know, the Japanese whiskey scene is very big, and both of them are extremely expensive because the supply is very, very limited. I gotta say, as much as I like a nice glass every once in a while, I'm not the biggest fan of the peatiness and the smokiness of Scotch. I can appreciate it. Sometimes I'll love my, you know, Hibiki or something like that, but, and it's more of the mood is right, especially if I'm in Japan or if I'm in a really nice situation where I want to drink, you know, Scotch on the rocks or something to that degree. But I've always been a bourbon person over Scotch, always American bourbon and whiskey, simply because it's domestic and simply because it has its own history in and of itself. It's not that I don't appreciate it, but I say I definitely have had more Japanese whiskey. I'm just not the biggest fan of, I would say, again, if I had to choose an area, and there's many holes in my food knowledge game, Scotch and Japanese whiskey would be one of them. But I'd always feel that some of the Japanese whiskeys in general are less smoky than the stuff you would get in Scotland. I would also say that of the Scotch that I've had, a lot of it has been consumed in Korea or in Korean karaoke bars. Because I don't know much about the data, but I know Diageo owns Johnny Walker. Johnny Walker seems to make every sort of, it's almost like a sneaker drop of colors specifically for Korean people. I don't know what it is about Korean people, but man, it's like, dude, they got the Johnny Walker turquoise. Gotta buy it. Let's drink it. And then they'll buy the most expensive Johnny Walker and like drop it in a shot of beer. It's so dumb.
This is hitting really close to home.
Because it's true. It's I cannot, nor will I ever understand the fascination that Korean culture has with Johnny Walker, and specifically Johnny Walker. They're like sneakerheads for Air Jordans. You know, it's so weird that no matter what, they have to buy it and they have to drink it. And it has to be the rarer the color is the one they want to drink. Yeah, that's just like fact.
The blue one is like the standard, like high-end Johnny Walker, right? And then whenever you're on a flight to Korea, you'll see it in the duty-free catalog, and it's priced just low enough to where you're going to buy it as a gift for your whoever you're seeing when you're there. Oh, my God.
So if you want a guaranteed gift, if you're visiting someone that's Korean, not Korean-American, if you're not sure what to do, and you do, when you visit somebody, and like if you're going to visit them, you need to bring a gift, correct, Yuno?
Yes. Do not go empty-handed.
There's only one surefire gift, regardless of gender, regardless of age, right? As long as they're old enough to drink, they're not like a late teenager, I think it's okay. There's only one universally accepted gift that you don't even have to worry about. And that's buying them a bottle of Johnny Walker. No, everyone's going to be like, you know, they're going to inside, they're going to be like, thank you. It's never going to be like, whoa, unless you get like the rarest drop of Johnny Walker ever. But if you just get them like a gold, a blue, I've even seen like a purple or something like that, turquoise. Like, then yeah, that's good. Gold is good.
Black's airing on the, that's more of an everyday drinker side.
So yeah. Gold, don't go black. Don't go black. Don't go red.
Yeah, definitely.
Green is good.
Green is nice.
See, and here's the thing. No offense, Johnny Walker. I think they all taste the fucking same.
Oh, man. The blue one goes down a lot easier, I think, for sure. The blue one goes down pretty easy.
Somebody, all I'm trying to say is, reminder, folks, that you know is a giant Korean person who's consumed a lot of Johnny Walker. I don't understand why, but no other culture I know is where Johnny Walker is literally catnip. It's so weird.
It's insane. And like you said, it's such a reliable gift. You know what I mean? Like, not overshooting, just right. So,
you know, I've had a bunch of Bushmills. I have a bunch of Dewars. And, you know, one of my proud items is a rare bottle of Bushmills that Patrick Stewart, you know, Picard gave me. He had him and I think Jonathan Riker, number two, bought a couple barrels in like the last days of Star Trek, and they bottled it. And I received one from Patrick Stewart. It's one of my most cherished items. It's an engraved bottle of Patrick Stewart's own Bushmills whiskey. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Dave, you mentioned something a little bit back that kind of piqued my interest. Karaoke bars. What's your number 18? What's your go-to song?
I don't do karaoke. I have, but that's when I used to drink a lot. And even when I did, it would be, I just don't, here's the thing. I don't dance and I don't sing. And I just can't. So if I have a song, I don't even know what it is because I don't even karaoke. And I understand if you're in Korea or if you go to K-Town LA, sometimes that's not an option. But I don't really have that many karaoke moments.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, facts.
I can believe it, but I can't believe it. Like, I believe it about you. I just can't believe. All right. Well, let's.
What's your karaoke song? Like, I can't act. I can't. There's something about being that. I can be embarrassing in other ways, and I can put myself out there in the world in other ways that most people may not, and be, again, as Jerry Saltz says, naked. But the idea of being naked in an optional fashion where nothing is on the line, right? Mm-hmm. Dancing in front of people, like, it drives my wife crazy. I can't do it. It's almost like some kind of learning disorder, disability. I can't.
We're like,
and singing in public, I can't do it. Yeah. I'm for those that can, it's always amazing. Good for you, but it's not for me.
Fair enough. Learn something new today. Okay, this is an easy one. Hi, Dave. If you could only put one condiment sauce on top of your meals for the rest of your life, what would you choose?
And I can't say Momofuku Chili Crunch.
No, you can't say, you can't plug the Momo
sauce. And I can't say Momofuku Hot Honey. And I can't say Momofuku Savory Salt.
Yeah. As he goes through and says them all.
One condiment that you put on everything, like, it's not ketchup. Is it hot sauce, he said?
It's one condiment / sauce. Could be a condiment, could be a sauce. I mean, I think for most people it's the same thing, right? It's salt, right? Like, wouldn't you?
I don't view that as a condiment though. I'm thinking like I'm putting this in the lens that it's gotta be some kind of saucy thing, like a ketchup. Or that's sriracha or something like that.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm going to say probably sriracha.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. If I can't use something called Momofuku Chili Crunch and I, or Lauga Ma or something that is, you know, of that word, or salsa matcha or something like that, or salsa in general, or seca, you know, if I have to do something that is a little bit more available. And that's why I think when you're saying condiment, I said it'd be something that is accessible, right? Like a Heinz 57 product or Tabasco. I'd probably say Tabasco too, but I love Tabasco, but it can't be like a knockoff, like Trader Joe's Sriracha's hot garbage.
You're talking about the, yeah.
Hui Foods original. That's what I would do. Or, you know what I would say? If it wasn't mass produced, I'd say a ginger scallion sauce or XO sauce. would be something I would put on. But if it is mass produced, I would say Sriracha.
Fair enough.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Vital Farms. No matter how you like your eggs scrambled, over easy, or sunny side up, the people at Vital Farms believe in one thing: keeping it bullshit free. That's why their pasture raised eggs come from hens who each have over 108 square feet of space to roam and forage all year round. So you can spend less time questioning your food and more time enjoying it. Look for Vital Farms in your grocery store and learn more at vitalfarms.com. Vital Farms, keeping it bullshit free.
This episode is brought to you by Jiffy Lube. Cars can be a big investment, so it's important to take care of them. I once got a car that I started out with 25,000 miles on. I got it to over 200,000 miles because I took care of it. You know how you take care of a car? You take care of the maintenance, the oil, the brakes, all that stuff. And if you don't, you can have a car just completely fall apart. When your car needs maintenance, head to Jiffy Lube. They provide automotive excellence at speed. Get your oil changed, brakes checked, tons of other multi-care services. It's all done by expertly trained technicians who actually care about taking care of you and your car. Jiffy Lube, car more. To find coupons and start an instant online estimate, visit JiffyLube.com.
What is the closest thing to Lucky Peach we currently have in today's food media? To me, it seems like no single entity has really come to replace it. Why is that? Grub Street, Eater, and Bon Appetit are all great, but they don't have the creative zest that LP had. My perception of it could be off, though, because I only discovered it recently.
You know, I think that's a good question, and I don't know if I'm going to answer that directly, but it's something I feel like if you've been listening to this podcast, we've talked about in subtler ways throughout the inception of the Real Podcast since we've been doing it. I'm beginning to think more and more. Not beginning to think more and more. I'm more confident that it's very rare where the underground or something that is left of center or the alternative actually infiltrates the mainstream in a complete revolution. And I think it was easier to do. When I mean like a revolution, I think that like it changes the way things are done and becomes sort of like a, not the mainstream per se, but in some way, because like this exponential growth that a lot of things have now, it grows too fast. And before social media, it had enough like energy to like slowly grow and build momentum into this avalanche, right? That would change. And I think a lot of the things that are alternative or different just don't have enough runway to really affect mass change. I think that also is tied into the fact that we live in a world where everyone can have their own bubble. And so it's almost impossible to penetrate things on a mass scale. Again, remind yourself that, I was just listening to Matt Bellany on Bill Simmons. The Cosby Show used to have 50% of the audience that watched TV on network television. There used to be three channels, right? So it was easier to sort of slowly grow an idea and to get, change to happen. I always think about when Nirvana happened. I don't think Nirvana happens today, right? It just wouldn't, right? Maybe it would, maybe it wouldn't. I don't know. It's not for me to sort of say because I can't control that. But I think it was easier to get momentum to be an alternative because in some way, you need to slowly build your fan base. And now you don't have the chance to build a fan base because it has to happen instantly. I don't know if what I'm saying makes sense to a degree, but anything that now is different because of technology, you can steal from it instantly. So it's very, also it's another level of difficulty to create a new train of thought. So number one, I think is because of the pockets. It's too fast. You need a slower trajectory to getting some kind of sustainability, a momentum. Two, I think that technology allows the bigger, more mainstream people to steal more quickly from anything that is new. And I think lastly, people are sort of set in their ways. I don't think people ultimately want too much change. They want the idea of it. They want the pulse that there are constantly new things on the horizon, on their social media feed, on their TV, in the newspaper, because that sense of change, that cadence, I think, allows people to sort of measure time to some degree, that there's movement in the world. But that's just it. It's just a reminder that change is happening. So it sounds a little bit too philosophical to me, just talking it out loud, but I just don't think people want change, right? For this degree, like, America will always be a steakhouse culture, always be a steakhouse culture. New York City, as an example, why, you know, you talk about something that's alternative. New York City prides itself on the cutting edge and the new, or at least it did. And the same criticism I gave to sort of, you know, the Bay Area many years ago with Bourdain about figs on a plate, I think is really true in New York City. And such as that, I think figs on the plate was a revolution in and of itself that actually won, right? And it's not just that, it's just, well, let me just specify this to New York. New York wanted the idea of new, but they don't want something so new that the gatekeepers can't control it, right? And it's one of the reasons why I feel like New York never, I think there's two reasons. One is what Alex Tupac brought up with restaurants. And I know I'm linking restaurants to, say, LP, but I do think there's some similarities. Doing something like Chicago has always adopted and wanted the avant-garde, because going out to dinner is an event out of the house, right? Where most people eat their meals at home. Whereas in New York, going to a restaurant is someone's canteen. And I know this from firsthand experience, right? It's just both as a resident of New York City and as a restaurant owner and chef, you see regulars because it's just too much of a pain in the ass to eat. So, like, to some degree, you want to have the cadence of the same. What New York wants, instead of cutting edge, is the fear of missing out, right? They want inaccessibility. But they want to broadcast that inaccessibility to everybody, right? It's the I'm in the in and you're on the out. And for you could do that with food to some degree, but it was just too insular and too inside baseball for everyone else. And I think for a lot of the critics, because they didn't know what the fuck was happening and they just didn't get it and they missed it completely. And I think one day that we'll be able to write the history that New York City really missed the opportunity to be a thought, like a progressive mover in modern food. So there's a lot of things that need to happen, but it's the same reason. Well, even if that did happen, I still think people just want comfort and they want the same and they want luxury and the trappings of that. And they also want to have supply and demand, right? I guess trying to talk it out loud and distill it. We want the idea that it's there. We want the option to change the channel, to read a new book, to read a new newspaper, new blog, new website, but it's not going to ever become your normal feed. In fact, most of the things that you might read now on your, you know, however you get information, both in news or entertainment, it's probably just tinged just with enough variety, but it's going to remain the same. And I guess it's just a long way of me saying that, you know, shit doesn't change nearly as much as you think.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously with the magazines, like, it has your captive attention. You pick up this physical thing and you read exclusively that, you know, but these days with your phone, you just need to swipe up and all of a sudden you know, it's different information. It just needs to differentiate itself slightly. But like, when you're talking about like New York and being supply and demand, can you kind of unpack that for me a little bit? Like, what does that mean? Like,
it's access. New York City is a lot of different things to a lot of people, but for people that live there that are in the creatively, even on the business end of things, right? New York City is all about who can get keys to access of things. That's really it, right? And like, that's what I mean is like that is what gets broadcast, but that's not avant-garde and that's not left to center. That's just limited supply. But that doesn't move the needle culturally. It used to, You know, when, again, when things, I think, moved a little bit slower, but with things moving so fast that it just doesn't have the ability to plant roots long term. And you need deep, long roots that's not just planted in the topsoil, but goes really deep down into culture. And I just think things move too fast. And since things move too fast, we over-index on access and the ephemeral nature of access rather than new ideas actually changing things. I don't know what I said. Listen, I've never articulated this before, so clearly it's a little bit mumble-jumbled. But I'll be working on it and trying to figure out how to articulate it even some more. But I think ultimately, trying to find a way to distill it into two sentences. One is people never really want to change. Two, technology prevents alternative things from really latching on and growing in a slower pace. I think that if you want change, it has to be deeply rooted and grow in a pace that is not accelerated like things are today.
Yeah.
Which is why you have a lot of zines now, you have a lot of alternatives, but it's never going to get the mainstream attention because the bigger people are stealing ideas from the smaller people. And it's so fractured that no one's going to know that theft is happening as well.
Hey, fellas, I was wondering, as someone who is handy in the kitchen without being a home chef, what are three dishes that everyone can and should learn to make that are incredibly good to eat, but don't require a disgusting amount of effort / weird kitchen utensils? Thanks for the show and the insight. Text from Adelaide, South Australia.
I think meatballs are super easy to make that you can sandbag, and you can make them a variety of cultures and flavors from Asia to Italy and everything in between, from dry to sauced or braised, lion's head, you know, turkey. I just think meatballs and ground meat is something I make quite a bit, especially with kids or even without kids. I just think it's delicious and easy. And even if you don't, I would say just anything ground beef. If you just have turkey and you just salt and like season it with salt and pepper, ground turkey or ground chicken, and you sort of smash burger that and you serve it with rice and the pickles, like it's a delicious, that's a delicious meal. Just to make sure you get it nice and crispy with a Maillard reaction. I think another thing I make is sandbaggable. We make a lot of pastas, right? And one of the things I make always is pesto. And it's one of the things that I make that like the kids and adults would eat. And I like it for the kids specifically. I can sneak in broccoli and I can sneak in out so much fat in the pine nuts. Pine nuts are traditionally in pesto, are basically just little fat bombs and the cheese and the salt. So, and just a copious amount of olive oil. I love that. And what I do is I will make a giant quart or two of pesto and freeze it. And I can add that to a lot of things. I can add that to flatbreads. I can add that to any pasta that's happening. Sometimes we might just buy pizza and I can put a little dollop on that. So as a, almost like a condiment, it's fantastic. I can put that now on roast chicken. You know, I think pesto is one of the most versatile sandbaggable things because frozen works great as well. And I like to make it simply because not necessarily cheap because pine nuts and Parmesan can be expensive, especially with olive oil, but it's something that's super easy to make. I will say that if you make it with a mortar and pestle, it is infinitely better than doing it in a blender. Sometimes I will make it in a mortar and pestle, but oftentimes I make it in a blender. It's like what? Pine nuts, olive oil, Parm, salt, pepper. Sometimes I might add a little bit of lemon juice. That's it. Garlic. Not that many ingredients for something that gives you almost what feels like an unlimited way of adding it to a variety of things. Another thing that I make that's sandbaggable is dashi, right? Sometimes I'll make proper Japanese style dashi. More often than not, I might use dashi packs that are Korean. And you can buy the same things that are Japanese, but the Korean dashi packs are different because they might have not just kombu, but have dried shellfish or dried fish. You need to be careful with the dried shellfish, like I do, because of shellfish allergies. But you can have a melchi broth, like an anchovy dashi. And the reason I have that on hand, or I make it very quickly, I might just bring up some water, bring it to a boil, and then add those packs. And I might do that. Like when I leave, before I leave work, I leave for work, and just put a lid on that and let it steep all day. And when I get home, I have it ready to go. So I can now turn that into like Korean doenjang jjigae. So again, I can, with that broth, I can add zucchini, garlic, tofu, mushrooms. And I have a really hearty, delicious stew, mushrooms. Or I can do it as a janji guksu. So it's like I could turn that into like somen, or I could turn that into like a base for like a stew or a braise. Or I could turn that into cold dipping noodles, right? Or I could use that as a base to make it like mori soba with dried soba noodles. Or something that I do quite a bit, I could use that dashi as the liquid environment for rice to make a pot of donabe, right? So that liquid is gives me extraordinary amount of versatility, right? So all kinds of noodles, both cold and hot, I can make. I cannot even make a doenjang jjigae. I could just make that as miso, right? I can turn that into a straight like shiro miso. I can now use that. And if I want to make a sukiyaki, I can use that as the base to braise, you know, konnyaku, which is devil's root, chicken. I have, you know, any kind of other thin protein, green veg, and I have like sukiyaki. Or I could turn it into more Korean thing and make it a jongo, which is more of like a cross between like a soup and stew, right? More or less, right? I can add shellfish. I can cook crabs, and I can turn that into a maewantan, right? Which is like a spicy seafood fish type of thing. All of that is possible because I now have a liquid environment that has a lot of umami that is a different kind of dashi. So again, I'll use make it Korean or Japanese. And when I have that on hand, I feel almost empowered. It gives me confidence to know that I can cook a lot of different things. I have to remind myself that I have to make it more often. Because I will say that if you don't have it ready, you still need an hour to prepare it if you don't have that liquid ready. So I do like having it. I do like steeping it in the morning. Or, you know, I might bring it to boil, or I might just keep it in the refrigerator and strain it out later. I do like the dashi packs because I don't need to have cheesecloth or strain it out with all the particulates of katsuobushi if I make a Japanese one. And oftentimes I don't use kombu either, but that's there. Another thing I can do if I have that, if I have pork belly, I'll just do braised pork belly. So I will cut up some pork belly. I will sear it off with salt, and then I will add sugar and soy and the dashi and garlic and ginger, and I will boil the shit out of that. And what really I get is a very light tonkotsu style broth, right? Not tonkotsu, it's just I turn it into ramen. So again, like that gives me so much a variety, or I can make a milfui nabe. So I give you all the dishes that I literally make. I can still use that liquid, and I can make a chawanmushi in the any day, or a gerangjim if I wanted to cook it more of a Korean style. So it's funny how important that broth is, that flavor is to me, because it's probably the cornerstone of when I cook anything. And if I don't have that, I cook completely different foods. But if I'm making Asian flavored, particularly Korean or Japanese food, I can't make Korean or Japanese food without that. Is there anything else that's easy to make? Oh, we've talked about this before, and I do this a lot, especially in the mornings. I have crepe batter a lot in my house, which is easy. It's one egg to one cup of flour to one cup of milk. It's a little salt. You just blend that together. I just do that in a NutriBullet, and I'll just keep that in the fridge. And that gives me the ability to make like a big pancake. Like I can cook like a thick one in a nonstick pan, and I can actually put layer upon layer. So I'll cook one piece without turning into a proper crepe, and then put another. So it's like relatively thick, and I can serve that with butter and pancakes, like a pancake. I could really crisp it up with a lot of oil and butter, and I could almost turn that into like a flour tortilla with cheese. So it gives me optionality for lunch. It's also things that I like. I can, so it gives me breakfast. It gives me lunch. And not really dinner. And I can also make it super sweet. That's not a pancake, by just putting it in a jam and rolling it up. So I like having that. It's super simple to make, but when I have it in my house, inevitably I almost make just cheese crepes for the kids all the time.
That's a pretty good solution. Hey, regarding the stock, are you able to freeze that? Does it lose anything if you freeze it?
You can definitely freeze it, but I don't think there's any reason to freeze it because it takes almost no time. And in terms of the volume that you're going to make, you want to make, yes. And for home cook, I don't think it matters, but listen, the art of making dashi is truly an art in and of itself. So there's restaurant level and high end level making dashi. This is not that, you know, I've been privy and being able to witness and to work. And I think some of the best, dashi in the world, where you're shaving the katsuo a la minute. I've seen other things that were cooked, like baby bluefin tuna that's been turned into bushi. That is super delicious. And you're shaving that, and the temperature is exact, and you're extracting it like a tea. You're never boiling it. There's a lot of things you can do, and it's made fresh. Sometimes it's made multiple times a day because flavor can dissipate. And if you make a bad, you know, and you can make a remoulade. So that's the French term for a second or third batch, especially when you make like a veal stock, because the veal bones are so expensive. You do that with dashi as well, because dashi is not cheap. So that first press, that first boil of dashi, if you're just using Japanese katsuobushi style, like traditional, I almost never do that with kombu. I almost always get it straight with really good katsuo. I only get like that first batch with just the bonito. Then I will do a kombu one, which again is not necessarily what people would do, but I just want pure, clean flavor if I'm making katsuo. Because if you add the seaweed, the kombu, it really dramatically alters the flavor, in my opinion, and a little bit goes a long way. And that's why I do it differently. Or sometimes back in the day, I would just make a kombu dashi and a katsuobushi dashi. And I would blend that together at the end, like a cuvée in a dish. And I've seen that before in a lot of kitchens as well. But restaurant level dashi making is, it's like its own station to a degree. And I would not do that at home. And also home cooks just do not get the level of katsuobushi you would get at a higher level place. It's just not happening. That being said, if you lived in Japan, there are like a baker and a meatmonger, there are places that you could just buy dashi. There are people that just shave shit and a variety of different qualities for you, because that's how important it is to Japanese cuisine. As it relates to Korean food, it's so easy to make, because you could just, you know, my mom used to have like this, like basically like a tea ball, and she would just stuff it full of anchovies and she would make, you know, melchi broth. That way melchi is Korean for anchovy. Or pollock, right? Dried, any kind of dried fish, ultimately, if you cook in water and steep, you're going to get a very flavorful liquid. So Japanese dashi is much like, as an example, like miso versus Korean doenjja, right? Or better yet, shiso versus gyeongnyeob, right? A Korean dashi is more powerful. It is, and the dashi packs clearly are a nice balance, because they're portioned out and you use one pack for maybe 4 cups of water or something like that. You still get different flavors than you would normally get in just katsuobushi. But I find the dashi packs are just flavorful enough that it's a dashi. But if you wanted to make like real Korean flavored broths, in my opinion, those are like a completely different language than the Japanese dashi. Super fishy, and not in a bad way, right? It's fucking intensely fishy in a good way. So I'm a little less precious when I make Korean kind of stuff, right? To me, Japanese flavors are always cleaner. And when it's not, when I get a second or third pressing of dashi as a remi, I'm using the second or third as a braise or a stew or something that is going to be more muddled in flavor in a good way as well.
Interesting. All right. Thanks, Dave.
Was that useful at all?
It was. I mean, it really kind of like got into, and it's really fascinating to hear how your mind works. Because when you're like talking about, hey, from this thing, all these other dishes can be made and they're all like pretty like accessible dishes, right? So I think that's the part where I really enjoyed where I was like,
no, it's true. It's like, this is where sometimes, like, I remember when I first started cooking, I didn't understand when, you know, everyone has their own way of coming up with a dish. For me, it's very different, right? Like, I almost always work with a protein backwards. A lot of people, I think, look at the market vegetables first and then build it that way. To me, it's not necessarily protein. I need to have one element done, right? That is crucial. When I say meat, for me, it's got to be not necessarily meat, but one element of a dish that gives me optionality, right? So when I say chicken, like a whole chicken, like that would be an example. Then I can like work my way. It's like, you know, reverse engineering, like, oh, I can go here, I can go here, I can go here. It allows me to connect the dots in real time with the ingredients that are on hand. So it's almost like working backwards and seeing, you know, which paths I could take with ingredients that I have in my pantry or my refrigerator or my freezer. So I can work backwards from there. So so instead of using chicken, like if I have dashi on hand, I can now be like, oh, I don't have any somen, I don't have any soba, and I do have a lot of rice. I'll do that. Or I have all that older rice in the rice cooker. I'll just turn that into a juk today with the, you know, so that philosophy or mind of thought thinking has really been the same for me in a professional setting as well. So I just need one thing that can turn into a lot of different things. I've never been good to just look at a tomato and be like, well, I'm going to make a bruschetta and I want to turn this into a red sauce and I want to do a salad from this. Yeah, I do, but, I need it to be working with other things. In a weird way, I've never been vegetable focused to that degree. Although I've had a lot of vegetables dishes, I've never looked at the market and be like, yes, this is what I'm going to do, which I feel like is how most people think about making dishes.
That's a really interesting insight, Dave. Because like every chef I've talked to tends to look at it the opposite way, like you're talking about, right? And it's kind of like a inductive process of like, oh, tomatoes, what can I make with this? Whereas you're kind of looking at it as like, here's what I got. It's a challenge. All right, now whip something up, right? And let's figure this out, right? So it's just a different way of thinking. It's almost like the difference between deductive and like inductive reasoning, right? It's like,
well, it's inevitable. It's like, yeah, like, okay, it's tomato season. Like, I just know certain things are there, but it's also what is available, you know? And when I have, if I look at like an heirloom tomato and it's like, okay, there's only so many things I can make with this, right? I can do it as a salad. I can make it a gazpacho. I can make it as a sandwich. I can turn it into a sauce, right? There's actually not that many ways, right? Whereas if I'm working backwards, right? And let's just say, I'm using chicken and not a dashi, right? It's like, okay, I have this chicken. I look in my fridge. I have some fresh tomatoes. I got a half a can of like, you know, chickpeas, right? And that could be no different than that if I was in a restaurant. I was like, okay, we have some, you know, cannellini beans. We got some black kale. We have some garlic confit. It's like, okay, I know that tomato cooked down, peeled will go well with this, you know? It's like working my way backwards from the flavor or what I have with everything else and knowing that the lowest hanging fruit is that I got a delicious tomato.
It's really interesting. I'm trying to think back to, do you remember that family meal where you made the couscous with the chicken thighs? Do you remember that?
Right.
With the chickpeas?
Yeah, I do.
I was fucking blown away, right? And you were just kind of like, none of it seemed very like, you know, systematically like developed, right? It was just more kind of like, okay, here's what we got on hand, and then you just kind of do this thing, and then, you know, a few moments later, you know, Dave things, and then out pops this amazing chicken thigh with like, you know,
well, that's the thing, it's like, yeah, so what, you know, is referring to, I don't know if we've videotaped it, but we had chicken thighs, right? And we were trying to make family meal, and we, you know, it's like, okay, what do we have? We actually have like nothing other than chicken thighs, if I recall. So it's like, okay, like, what can I do with that? So a lot of it is out of not a desire or need. It's almost like desperation. You know, it's like I have nothing else to do. So when I have too many options to start, I think that's the best way I could phrase it. If I have too many options at my disposal to start, I'm not able to process a way to whittle it down, right? So for me, I need to work my way backwards from a fundamental component of a dish, right? So I didn't even look at the couscous. It was like, I know I have to use protein. I have this chicken. I have to use it. So what could I do? I could salt and pepper roast. You know, one of the best recipes is just family, you know, chicken. Just put it on a sheet tray, salt and pepper liberally, and then full blast, almost on a broil setting, on a sheet tray with a wire rack. And it's fucking awesome. You know, I could have done that. I could have done a braise, but then you have to calculate how much time do I have, right? And if I was in a restaurant setting, like making a like chicken thigh dish, I'd be like, okay, it's like, how do I make it this now that's easy for mise en place, but also delicious, and work my way backwards. Like, so I'm a restaurant and I'm always thinking about the execution of it rather than me just fucking around trying to make it work. So then it's like, okay, like what other vegetables do I have? And I think that we didn't have any vegetables. We had some olives and we had
potatoes
and couscous.
Yeah.
So like, to me, I just started thinking about like tagine flavors. And then, okay, so it's like, okay. And I knew we had chickpeas. So it's like, okay, like that's what we're going to do. And you just put it together. I think I added some fruit. What was the fruit I added some kind of citrus lemon. In there.
Yeah, lemon. Yeah. And a couple of sprigs of thyme, I think.
Yeah, and it came out great. But like, it wasn't like, oh, I got to make a braised chicken dish.
Yeah.
With rice. You know, it was, I got to use this chicken. How do I make this delicious? And also somebody couldn't eat spicy, so couldn't it be spicy? So it's really deductive sort of process. Well, guys, keep on sending your emails to Ask Dave. I'm happy to answer anything that's not even food related. But we're in Las Vegas. We don't have Chris Ying. There's a lot happening right now. Again, if you're listening to this, maybe you're on a plane, maybe you're driving. It is unequivocally one of the worst times to travel, but everyone has to travel to see their family and friends. So I hope you have a good week of travel. And if you're not traveling, I hope you listen to our advice and you have bought your herbs a couple days earlier and you are sitting on a stockpile of cream and butter and milk and you have your turkey ready to go. And you are now, since it's Monday, maybe tomorrow I would make my mashed potatoes and my green bean casserole and all the things I can sandbag. Again, remember, Thanksgiving Day is almost everything is done, can be done ahead of time, including the gravy. The only thing you can't do is a turkey unless you smoke that fucker, right? So yeah, enjoy. And we have another broadcast coming out on Thursday, Thanksgiving Day. And yeah, remember that we'll see you all on Friday in New York City, where the Jets play the Dolphins. And we are going to do a lot of culinary things with the Thursday night football team. 3 p.m. Eastern time, 12 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Should be a lot of fun, and I hope I don't cut myself on national TV. Bye. Available on Prime.